Welcome to the SAG-AFTRA Foundation's Conversations podcast. The SAG-AFTRA Foundation believes that contributions made to our culture by performing arts are not only valuable, but also essential. And so we provide free programming and services like this podcast to support them. If you'd like to learn more about the SAG-AFTRA Foundation or access the full library of our conversations or make a donation to support this podcast, please visit sagaftra.foundation. That's www.sagaftra.foundation. Also, subscribe to our YouTube channel and follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at SAG-AFTRA-Found. Thanks, and enjoy the conversation.
Actor, playwright. He's an accomplished author as well. He published a book last year. He's done some wonderful work in television shows that include everything from Murphy Brown to Boston Public and Boston Legal. He won an Emmy for his role as Beverly Leslie on Will and Grace. He's a terrific actor. Please welcome Leslie Jordan.
Thank you.
That's it.
Wow.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Was that an okay introduction? After 20 several years that it's been?
1983,
wasn't it? And that was shortly after you had come to town, wasn't it?
I stepped off a bus. A bus. Could not afford a plane. Couldn't even afford Greyhound. It was a Trailways. I stepped off a bus at the corner of Vine Street and Daylong Prey. There's a McDonald's, and back behind that McDonald's was an old bus station.
Yeah.
And I had a suitcase, a tiny little suitcase. I had $1,200 sewn into my underpants because I was afraid I'd get robbed on that bus. That was actually my mother's idea. And I had dreams. That was 1982. And I had $1,200 that I had saved waiting tables. And I was not a spring chicken either. I was 27 when I got here.
Wow.
So, you know, you can start at any point. I was 27. Now, I did have a degree in theater. I had wanted to be a jockey with racehorses. I rode horses my whole life. And so I had, for my 20s, from I was about 19 to 25 or so, I worked at racetracks all around the country, exercising. I was never good enough to exercise. I actually did ride a few races, but it was disastrous. It would be almost like training to be a actor, like training, because I was an exercise rider in the morning. And then it'd be like training to be an actor for 4 years, and then you walk on stage or walk in front of a camera, and within 2 minutes you think, I can't do this. Because I got in a race, and, you know, the gates open and boom. And I thought, I can't do this. What am I doing on a racehorse flying up the middle of the racetrack?
But that's got to be fairly terrifying.
Oh, it's if you've ever been to the races, you don't realize how loud it is down there. And all those other jockeys are so kind to you in the dressing room, you know. Oh, we'll watch out.
Yeah.
Elbows. And see, there's cameras, so they know. So they're not supposed to do stuff, but they know exactly where each camera picks up the other camera. And, so anyway, I did that for years and years and years. And then went back to school.
Where'd you go to school?
I went to the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga, you know, our, local campus. And they had given, unbeknownst to me, they had built a $7 million theater facility. And they had hired this 33-year-old theatrician. I think I made that word up.
Theatrician.
A theatrician. This Dr. Fred Berenger, who became my mentor. And I was going to maybe study journalism. I was 27 years old, and I had gotten really sick. I'd end up in the hospital trying to lose the weight because I'm short like a jockey, but I'm not skinny, you know. And so I had gone on. Well, I did have, never mind, I won't get into all that, but I did have a tiny cocaine problem. But we won't go into that.
We'll get there later.
We'll get there later.
Okay.
That was my diet to keep, you know.
Instead, you can lose a lot of weight that way, though. So.
Listen, I talk warts and all, because if I get any more famous than I am and they want to write anything about me in those magazines, it's public knowledge.
Yeah.
Nothing they can get on me.
You inoculate them.
Nothing they can get on me.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
And I do talk about it because I'm in recovery, you know, many years now, many, many years, over 10 years recovery. But anyway, I had been on the cocaine diet for several years, and I got really, really sick, and I was physically sick, really bad sick, and from trying to lose the weight. And so I thought, what am I going to do? Well, a friend of mine said, you ought to take, you have to get your electives out of the way. And to get that art elective out of the way, why don't you take intro to theater? And that will get your arts elective out of the way. I had never once thought about being an actor, but I was always funny because it kept the bullies at bay. I was such a sissy when I was a kid, and they would play dodgeball, you know, and smear the queer, and they'd try to hit me with that dodgeball. And I learned at an early age, if I could make those bullies laugh, I could keep them at bay. And so I've always been the class clown. Well, I walked into that class. Now, I also have identical twin sisters that are, they're 22 months younger than me. And we grew up in the 50s and the 60s. And my mother, they had blonde Shirley Temple ringlets below their butts. They wore big blue eyes, wore bows in their hair. And everywhere we went, they got all the attention. And my mother said when I was a kid, I would spit on the floor. I would turn cartwheels. I'd pull my pee-pee out. Anything, anything to get people. You know, when I was a kid, I've been in therapy about it for years because I'm addicted. I can't get enough attention. So I went into that class. I went into that class, that acting class, and we did improvisations, you know. And I got on my feet, and I was funny, and I heard that laughter, and I'm telling you, it hit me like a drug. And I went to the head of the theater department that afternoon, and I said, this is what I want to do. You tell me, you know, you tell me what I need to do this, so I can get more of that. But I did, and I got a degree in theater.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you know, you're talking about your family. You've got pictures of the family up on your website. Yeah, in there?
Do I?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So we saw those little ringlets in the...
Yeah, my twin sisters.
Yeah. And now they're out here in California now, or no?
They have worked in the hotel industry for years and years and years, and one does food and the other does beverage, and they've never married. Now, they're the characters. I'm not the character. When you get around my sisters, they're the characters.
Yeah.
And Yammer Yammer, blah, 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 blah. And they run the hotel where Tiger Woods just won the U.S. Open. It's a beautiful hotel called the Torrey Pines Resort.
Oh, right. Okay.
And they do the food and the beverage and everything.
Cool. Tell us a little bit more about, you know, what it was like growing up in Chattanooga and, you know...
Well,
let's you know, look at the formative years.
My daddy was a lieutenant colonel in the Army, and I sort of fell out of the womb, and I landed in my mother's high heels. And so I was not exactly the son that my dad envisioned, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted me, when people would ask me when I was little what I wanted to be when I grew up, they would ask me, do you want to be a fireman or do you want to be president? And I said, no, I want to be a go-go dancer. I had watched that long before MTV was Shindig, which we were talking Hullabaloo.
Right.
And they had those dancers on those boxes. And I was transfixed. And I would practice. I'd get up on the coffee table. I had one 45. It was... Wipeout by the Safaris. And you have to remember, you'd take the record and then you had to put that little plastic piece in the middle.
Yeah, the adapter.
And then you'd turn it from 33 to 45.
Right.
And my daddy would come home with all of his Army buddies. And I would be, Daddy, watch me do the pony. I would be dancing on the coffee table. And so my dad, I tell you, I think everything that we have done as kids has affected us as adults. And my dad was killed in a plane crash when I was 11 years old. And I can remember knowing to the core of my being that he went to his grave a little ashamed to have a son like me. And yet I didn't really know what like me was. But I'll tell you the journey, the most interesting journey, and it has so much to do with acting, because when I first started acting, I thought acting was being another character, you know, that I would get rid of this, get rid of me, and I would be another character. The more that I'm around actors and the more I find out that, you know, acting is, if you don't know who you are, you know, and you are not comfortable in your own skin, you know, it's really hard to take on another character. And so I think the whole, you know, I got here in 82, and I remember, you have to understand that 1982, when I stepped off the bus, is before Ellen DeGeneres mm-hmm. show. It's before mm-hmm. Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, mm-hmm. way before Queer as Folk. And I remember thinking when I got off that bus, it might not be a good idea here in Hollywood to let anybody know mm-hmm. that I am a homosexual. And so, now, why is that funny? Well, that's funny because if you know me today with who I am and what I'm about, but it was not like that, you know, in 82. And we studied with this lady named Carolyn Berry, who she's still teaching, by the way. She's one of the best teachers, I think, in town, because she has a belief that it's two words, show business, business being the most important word, that you have got to approach it. It's now Leslie Jordan Incorporated. I have started a company. Okay, what do you do when you start a company? First of all, you have to find out what you're selling, you know? You have to find out, because you're in a town where there's so much competition. And see, I was coming from theater where they would let us play old men, and they would let us play, you know, and they would say, this is a stretch. Well, that ain't going to happen here, folks, you know. I'm not going to play usually a father of five, you know, with a wife. That's just not what I'm going to play. But Carolyn's the first person that called me aside, because I wore cowboy boots back then, and I had this mustache. I had this big mustache. But it was the 80s, so people wore mustaches. Yeah. I had this big old mustache. And I would kind of, like, you know, lower my voice and try to kind of butch it up, you know.
And it worked, by the way.
Carolyn's the first person that called me aside, and she said, I think I know, you know, what's up here. And she said, I want to tell you that with you, you know, it is not going to matter one iota. It's what is going to make you who you are. And it's what, you know, so thus began this sort of journey where I had to get comfortable enough in my own skin to be who I was, you know. Because when we get up in front of people and we're not being who we are, it's such a hard thing to explain, but I think you're with me. Mm-hmm. You know, to take on a character, like I decided, okay, look, I'll probably never be a Robert De Niro or a Meryl Streep. I'll probably never be that kind of actor who can just disappear into a role. Because mm-hmm. quite frankly, I've never been asked to play a character that I thought was more interesting than me in real life. So I thought, you know, what are my choices here? Because my manager and I recently also, we've reached a point in my career where we can go two ways, and we can solidly go two ways. One is we can sell me as a personality. You know, do we want to get me a talk show? Because I could yammer, I could, you know, I'd be good at a talk show. Do we want, you know, I've been offered the surreal life. I've been $50,000 they offered me to be. No, but I don't want to do that. You know, that would be the death. I thought, I think of myself on the rise, you know.
Yeah.
Those people are kind of on the descend.
Kind of.
So, but do we want to sell me as a personality, or do we want to continue with what I want to do, which is I'm an actor, you know? Like I said, I'm not a Meryl Streep. I'm not a Robert De Niro. I do what I do, but I do the very best Leslie Jordan that I know how to do, and different facets of me. But, you know, just even losing the... God, you haven't even asked a question yet.
I'm
so sorry.
I'm having a great time here, you know. Still long for the ride.
But I've gone through this whole thing. Like when I first got here, there was a wonderful casting director named Pam Sparks, and she sat me down, and she said, you know, honey, you are such a character, such a character. I think if you don't work on being able to, if asked, to remove your Southern accent, I think it's going to limit, because at the time what I was mainly doing were commercials. Mm-hmm. That's what happened. The year I got off the bus in 1882 was the year Clara Peller, this wonderful character actor from Chicago, in a Wendy's commercial said, where's the beef? Where's the beef? And all of a sudden, that's what they wanted in commercials. Up to that point, if you wanted to be in a commercial, you had to look, you know, like a model. All of a sudden, they wanted different characters. And I had this perfect, and that's what I did for years. You know, I was the, God, I was the Pip printing guy. I was the Del Taco boy. Morning, boys. How about breakfast? Same place, same thing. Anyway, I did that. But Pam Sparks set me down and she said, honey, you've got to work on being able to rid yourself of that accent. Mm. And I, you know, I went over to Samuel French and I got the tapes and I tried, you know, I tried so hard, y'all. And I would call home. My mother would go, why are you talking like that? Now, I realized, you know, that for me, I'm not sure this applies to everyone, but for me, if they're going to take this, they're going to take the Southern accent. But I tried so hard. But the same casting director, years later, was casting, when the Jeffersons went off the air, they were casting Wheezy Jefferson was going to spin off into Honeymoon Hotel. She was going to have a hotel. And they wanted the dumb security guard kept shooting himself in the foot with his gun. They wanted Don Knotts, you know, from Mayberry, from the old Andy Griffith show. So I auditioned and auditioned and auditioned. Finally, we're standing outside Fred Silverman's office, who was God in those days in television. And Pam has her hand on the doorknob. And she said, now listen, I know that you've auditioned for a lot of people, but we don't want anything different, honey, okay? We just want you to go in and do you. And I said, I don't know if you remember this, but years ago, you gave me some advice, and I've been thinking about it a lot, and I think I'm going to drop the accent. I said, I'm going to try it without my Southern accent. She went completely white. She said, don't fucking do this to me. And I said, I'm kidding. She was like, she said, don't you ever do that to me. Ever. So.
Gave her a little scare there, you know.
But you know what? I don't know what advice I would give if someone said to me, do you want to rid myself of my accent? Because, you know, the industry is such today that you are going to get cast. There's so much diversity and there's so many shows. And, you know, I just don't know if you're going to be, if I should advise you to keep that accent and, you know, or what. I just don't know. I mean, theater's a whole different story. You know, if you're gonna, you know, go to New York and do theater, you have to be able to drop the accent and stuff. But, you know, well, I mean, there's
kind of two different kinds of actors out there. I mean, there are actors like Humphrey Bogart and John Wayne, and they never really got into somebody else's skin. You were always watching them.
Right.
But like you said, it was a different facet of who they are. I'm not sure that that's a lower level of actor or something, or that, you know, I don't know.
I've lost jobs because of it. Mm-hmm. I've had horribly humiliating situations. They hired me once to play a Ferengi on Star Trek. And a Ferengi is a character with these big ears, and his ears are his erogenous zones. And I had to lay with straws up my nose. It was 40 separate prosthetic pieces. It was fake teeth. It was gold spec contact lenses. It was excruciating. It was the worst thing I don't ever want to do prosthetics again. But they had just sort of hired me without asking or thinking of my accent. So I strolled onto the... And there was that, you know, that actress who, she's so... Kate...
Yeah, Mulgrew.
Mulgrew, something she's daddy, you know.
She's very proper, and she's a trained actor from New York, and she did her line, and then I did mine. And the director goes, cut! He said, this ain't Deep South Nine. He said, could you bring that Ferengi a little south of the Mason-Dixon? Well, I was just horrified, and so... And then it became like the set joke, because I would try to speak without my accent, and I would lapse into Cockney. Like, I don't know where that came from. Like, Eliza Doolittle. And so he said, Mr. Jordan, first of all, feather does not have four syllables. Yeah, it was so humiliating. And then what had to happen was we shot the episode, and then they got a linguist who sat with me, and I had to loop my entire performance.
Oh, my goodness.
And then my manager called, and he said, you know, in spite of what you said, you scored a coup. They want you back. And your scenes are going to be with Whoopi Goldberg. And I said, I don't care if they're with Jesus Christ. I don't want to go back ever. And I wouldn't do it. And my manager said, Leslie, what you don't understand, if those characters take off, you can go to those conventions and you don't have to wear all that stuff. Yeah. And you can make $5,000 to $10,000 a day, you know? And I said, I don't
Not
care.
Yeah.
I've done Smurfs. I was a Care Bear out on Sunset Boulevard. I danced in a little Care Bear costume. And I've done a National Smurf commercial. I said, I don't do prosthetics. I don't do it anymore.
I will not
do prosthetics.
You got to draw the line somewhere.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll go so low, but.
Yeah. You know, I saw on your resume, you did a Pee Wee's Playhouse,
uh-huh.
Is that right?
I did.
It just made me think of that. I guess Smurfs or Care Bears or something.
You know, people talk about in Hollywood a break, and I thought, nobody gets like a break. You come and you get a part and another part. But I really did get a break. The very first season of Murphy Brown, the seventh episode, they hired me to be a secretary, which became a bit
Running
that
joke.
They used all 10 years.
Yep.
But I was supposed to be this really hapless guy who had been in prison for a crime I didn't commit. And when I got out of prison, I was still wearing what I wore before I went to prison. So I had on platform shoes and macrame belts. And I was just stuck in time back in the 70s. But anyway, we did a read through, and I got a lot of laughs on my little, I just had a tiny part. And then we showed up the next day, and there was a new script, and my part had gotten much bigger. So we read it again. I thought, wow. So we showed up the third day, and my part was huge. And so all the people like Faith Ford and Joe Riglabuto, the regulars, going, well, where's that funny? So Diane English, who created that, came to me, and she said, listen, we have not yet found our ensemble footing. We have given each of our regulars their show, and we love your work. Here's the ball. Go. And so the episode became Kyle. Well, the night it aired, my manager called me the next day, and he said, I've never had this happen. I've been in business 20 years. He said, Leslie, this phone is ringing off the wall. He said, Steven Spielberg saw it. I said, what? He said, his casting director wants to meet you about this thing. He said, Burt Reynolds saw it and thought you'd be funny with his wife at the time. Was that Lonnie Anderson? He said, Pee Wee. Paul Rubens saw it. So anyway, I ended up over at Pee Wee's and did an episode of Pee Wee's Playhouse.
And that was, what was your character? What did you do?
I was Busby, and what would happen was Pee Wee would say, where's my cereal bowl? Busby! I stole. I was the neighborhood thief. And where's my cereal bowl? And so what happens is, finally, he can't find his clothes, and then they catch me, and I'm dressed. And this Miss Yvonne, the most beautiful woman in the world, teaches me. She says, why do you dress up like Pee-wee, and why do you steal Pee-wee's stuff? I said, because I don't have any friends, and Pee-wee has a lot of friends. And, you know, she said, and then she teaches me, well, you don't have to act like Pee-wee to have friends. You have to act like yourself, Busby. So, anyway.
Well, let's go back just a little bit, if we can. You talked about your degree in theater from University of Tennessee, right? When you came out and you were studying at Carolyn Barry's place, you also did a lot of improv there, if I recall. What do you think about, I mean, what's the importance of improv? Has that served you well?
Absolutely. I think long before an actor gets a script in their hands, you should, and even if you are still doing your cold reading stuff, jump into improv classes, because number one, it gets you on your feet, thinking on your feet in front of people. I mean, I remember I wanted to be Butch, but I was more like this. And so I just didn't know how, but it gets you on your feet and you get rid of these ape arms, you know, that you don't know what, because bad acting is that, you know. And so you get on your feet and you learn to think on your feet. But most importantly, I think you learn to fall on your face. You learn to take risks and you learn that, okay, look, I just made a really big fool of myself. Because that's going to happen, you know. I don't know why we do what we do, and only we know why we do what we do. Why we are willing to stand in front of people practically naked, you know, I mean metaphorically, stand up there and let people see us in metaphorically speaking, naked, and why we do what we do. But I learned in the improv class was where I learned to take risks, you know, and I had a champion early in my career. Her name was Barbara Miller. She died a couple of years ago. But she was a casting director over at Warner Brothers. And I met her just like you do these, you know, little
showcases
where you meet people or like you pay to meet casting people, which I always thought was kind of bullshit. But I met this casting director and she started what she called, she used to say to me, honey, when you die, on your tombstone, it's going to say, here lies the other way to go. Because she would pull me into auditions and she would bring, let's say it was for a lawyer, or one time it was for a forensic guy, you know, picking the the carpet fiber samples. And she said, she pulled in people that looked like that, you know, three actors that looked like that. And then she would say to the producers, you know what, I've got this guy, and he's not probably what you thought of, but he's another way to go. And then they would bring me in, and sometimes it blew up right in our faces. Yeah. The people would be sitting there like, what the fuck were you thinking? But then there would be that time where I would walk in, and I would do the audition, and you see the people kind of lean forward, and, you know, they're thinking, well, my God, this is not... And I got one time one line in a George Clooney pilot long before he got famous. It was called Bodies of Evidence, and I had one line. I was supposed to say, these fiber samples do not match. Of course, you know, you've got one line, so you've got to give it your all. These fiber samples. You know, you got that one line.
Make the most. Yeah.
And I would say, you know, but I got the job. They decided that because this was such a serious big city, it would be nice to have a character, you know, doing, and I got a series regular role I ended up doing with George Clooney. I did 16 episodes. It was called Bodies of Evidence. It was George Clooney and Lee Horstley, who had just come off success as Matt Houston or right. some series
Something
he did.
Like that.
But
yeah.
What was the point of all that?
The other way to go.
Oh, the other way to go. But what was the question?
I don't remember. Improv. We started with improv. So,
improv.
Yeah, falling on your face.
But you know what else? Barbara Miller, and Barbara Miller would pull me in on everything, you know, mm-hmm. just little parts here and there. And sometimes it blew up in our faces. And, you know, I was the kind of person that when the audition went bad, I would sometimes get out and just walk all night long. You know, I look back and I think, why would you beat yourself up like that? But that's just what we do, you know? And I wish there was a way I could tell you. Because, you know, they tell you, go to the audition, do your best, and then...
Yeah.
And I think, it doesn't work that way. Right. What I want to do is this. I want to tell the people in the audition, listen, get in my car with me.
Yeah.
Because, seriously, come get with me, because on the way home, I am brilliant.
Yep.
I can think of 20 things that I could just slay you with.
Yep.
If you just get in the car with me and we'll drive home, you know, I'll take you to dinner, whatever you know, need to be. Because, you know, those auditions, the whole, but I tell you, I wish that each of you could jump to the point that I was able to jump to eventually. When I got to the point where I did not have to read for the casting people, and I'm not putting casting people down, mm-hmm. but you have to understand, they are second guessing what this person wants.
Right.
You know, the producer, when I could get past
the casting people, and I could get into the people that made the decisions, you know, that's when I started working. Because the casting people would think, you know, you're not
too risky.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was also so hard for me because they used words back then, like they would use words like, he's a little fey,
yeah,
little minty. Little minty? Too light in the loafers. Minty was
minty.
A big one. Little too light in the loafers. Mm-hmm. So I thank God had a gay agent. Now listen, yeah. I'll tell you something else, that the secret to Hollywood, and I was told this in jest. When I first got here, somebody said, get a gay agent and get a Jewish manager, and then you are set. And I'm telling you, that is the hierarchy right there, just about. If you, there's the pink mafia and there's the Jewish, you can get that, you're a set. And I had a gay Jewish agent.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
Michael Schlesinger for years. But luckily, I had an agent who was also gay. Now, he would call me up and say, keep your feet on the ground. This is not anything to woo, woo, woo.
Yeah.
Keep your feet on the ground. And so, but I, you know, I think the most important thing that I tell young actors is this, when you're approaching it. I tell them, go look up two words in the dictionary. I want you to look up vocation, and I want you to look up avocation. Now, your vocation is what you do to bring the money in. You're going to need one. You're going to need a vocation. You're probably going to need a vocation for about 5 years, because even if you're wildly successful, it's probably going to be 5 years before you are living. You know, see, that was my, when I get off that bus, that was my only goal. I said, I want to be able to earn a living as an actor. I've been doing that for 20 years. You know, I got off the bus 27 years ago. For the first seven, you know, I wasn't able to. But I, for 20 years, I've earned, I love that. I write, you know, occupation actor, you know, not actor slash waiter, not actor slash this. I am an actor. And also, if I had it to do over, I wish I had concentrated more in the early years on having a life. You know, I remember thinking, you know, God, when I get that series, man, you know, when I get this, you know, everything's going to be cool. And and then, you know, you're just anxious. And there was like that glass sort of thing that I just wanted to get past. If I can just, you know, just get in, want to get in. Just and what's in, you know, you don't know, but you're just frustrated. And so I wish that I had sort of just thought, you know what, it's going to happen the way it's going to happen, and I can't really make it happen. You know, I can do, I mean, if I wanted to be a nurse, you know, you go to school and you study, and you know you're going to get a job as a nurse. It's not guaranteed here. But I, then again, I don't want to be 80 years old looking back thinking, I could have, should have tried. So, you know, I think that if you get a good vocation, something you enjoy doing on the side, whether I loved waiting tables. I don't know why I did, but I loved it. It was like meeting people. And every time I hit that table, it was a new audience, you know, hello, la, la, la. And so I, you know, which is a perfect occupation for actors because you get that cash and you can also rearrange your schedule in case you do, you know, because the quandary for me early on was if I could do theater, I thought, you know, because I could show my chops. But if I have a night job, I can't do theater. But if I got a day job, what if I get an audition? And it was just constant, just, oh, just worry. There's just so much to worry about.
Yeah.
And, you know, am I going to, you know, am I going to have enough money to get these 8x10s? And it's just awful, just what I go through. You don't know what I go through. And, but, you know, if you have a good vocation and then acting is your avocation, you know, your avocation is what you do from the heart. And you go to your classes and you do the best you can. Now, of course, the goal is for your avocation to become your vocation. And that may happen. It may not happen, you know. But that's the goal. And meanwhile, you're doing what you love, you know. You're doing what you love. And you try. I tell you what really helped me was when I got into recovery 10 years ago. Because I'm a recovering drug addict. You know, I don't even like to talk about it because this is the oldest Hollywood story. Just, you know, started making money and just anyway. I'm just, they asked me in rehab, what was your drug of choice, Mr. Jordan? I said, well, what you had was my drug.
What do you got?
Whatever you had. I was ready. But,
But, you know, 10 years ago, I got into recovery, and they teach you in recovery to live in the moment. You know, that's the goal in recovery. And they teach you in recovery, it goes so hand in hand with the acting stuff. They teach you to do the footwork, you know, but you leave the result to whatever you believe in, and you have to believe. You know, I think it's important for actors also, and I don't like to get into this a lot, but you have to have a spiritual life. You know what I mean? What we do is spiritual, I think. And you have to have that. And so, you know, I was raised in the Baptist church. I've been baptized 14 times. It never did take.
Really, really?
Seriously,
really.
Dunked.
Immersion. Yeah.
Immersed.
Yeah,
none
yeah.
of the sprinkling stuff.
Yeah, huh.
They couldn't yeah. wash me clean.
No.
See, I knew I was...
Was
I
this
knew,
your choice or your mom's choice?
No. I knew that I was
it.
A homosexual from
oh.
a little kid.
Yeah.
And I knew that that was in the religion I was raised in was
right.
wrong.
Yeah.
But it
An
never made sense to me
it,
because
it,
I yeah. thought, you know what? With all due disrespect to the Christian right, there's no choice here.
Yeah.
You know, this is not a choice. This is not something I chose.
Right.
And so if God made me that way, then why, you know, it just none of it. Well, when I got into recovery 10 years ago was when that inner journey began, because the first thing they tell you in recovery is you have to believe in a power greater than yourself. It can be a doorknob. It can be, but it's got, you have got to believe, it could be nature. You can make it the AA meeting, you know, but you have got to believe in a power greater than yourself. And I'm telling you, this last 10 years was when I was able to take a deep breath, allow it to unfold the way it's supposed to unfold, do the footwork. You know, I get up every day and I'm at my desk from 10 to 12, about 2 hours a day. And people say, why don't you at your, you know, why don't you get a personal assistant? Why don't you, I love running my life. I love being on top of my career. I don't even have an agent right now.
Hmm.
My agency folded. I have a manager.
Yeah.
My agent became my manager.
Ah.
My agent of 20 or 30 years helped create Dharma and Greg. He had Jenna Elfman. She had one commercial. And then she got Dharma and Greg. No, one commercial. And then she got Townies with Molly Ringwald. And that went down the tubes. And then she... So my agent made a killing on Dharma and Greg. Retired, moved to Laguna. I said, you're 44 years old, Michael. You cannot retire. I'm 50. I can't go agent shopping. So he said, well, I've got... He said, Billy, the other agent in office, who was actually the workhorse, I called Michael the show horse, and Billy was the workhorse. I said, Billy, he said, Billy's going to take 7 of you if you want a manager. And so I have, for years now, I've had a manager and a lawyer. And, you know, but I'm kind of at a level where things are offered to me. And mm-hmm. and I think because I'm just about ready to take it to that next level, which would be like the CAA, the ICM, the big boys, because they do the packaging and... You know, so where are we?
That's okay. You're doing great. You're doing great.
Okay.
You said something earlier that just resonated with me, and that you know, you wish you would have known along the way to just live your life. You know, talk a little bit more about that. Elaborate on that.
Because I really do think I spent so many years waiting for that. Because I really did think, you know, if I get a television series. And I would imagine what it was going to be like, you know. I practice, we've all done this. I practice that speech in mm-hmm. front of my mirror,
mm-hmm.
you know, holding the hairbrush and who I was going to thank. And the interesting part is when I finally got an Emmy nomination, which absolutely came out of left field, I had recurred. They had written a part on Will and Grace for Joan Collins.
Mm-hmm.
And she was going to steal the maid Rosario, and they were going to have a dynasty cat fight and pull each other's wigs off. Well, at the last minute, Joan Collins' people came in and said, well, you can't pull her wig off. And they said, but that's the joke. They got rid of her. My manager called and said, look, they're looking for Truman Capote. They want a white suit. They want, the character's name is Beverly Leslie, and your name, it wasn't even written for me. Well, I walked in chattering like castanets, as I'm wont to do, and they just sat there, and they didn't even audition me. They said, that's it. That's it. So I did one, and then I started doing about 5 to 6 a year, and for 4 seasons, I was recurring. Out of the blue, my manager calls, Will and Grace is over. I did the finale. That's over with. My manager called and said, Leslie, you just got an Emmy nomination. I said, the only thing I could think of was I have a voiceover that I do for American Dad. I'm Mr. Beauregard, that cartoon American Dad. Uh-huh. I'm Mr. Beauregard, the Southern hairdresser who doesn't have any legs. He rides a little dog named Maverick. And I thought, well, maybe I got I said, for a voiceover? He said, no, for best guest actor in a comedy for Will and Grace. Well, it turns out if you do less than 5 in one season, you're considered a guest actor. So, but here I am at the Emmys. I had flown my mother out, bought her a $500 dress. First time my mother had ever flown first class. I put her up in this gorgeous little boutique hotel in West Hollywood. They sent a limousine to come get us. And I'm at the Emmys. And all I could think of was, God, I just wish I was home watching Forensic Files. But the point with the story was that all my life I thought, you know, that's what I wanted, you know, the fame of it all. And then you kind of get it and you realize, I tell you what George Clooney told me one time, and this was wonderful, because right when he started getting famous, I said, what's it like? Because that's what I want. Yeah. You know, maybe it's because I'm the short man, short man's ego. I want to walk into a 7-Eleven George in Omaha, Nebraska. I want him to shit and fall back on me. I want to be so famous, you know, I want to be like Madonna famous. I want to be able to walk into gay bars and just part, you know. And I want to be fierce, you know, and I want to work it. And you know what George said to me? I love this. George said, you know what it's like, Leslie? It's like when you were a kid and you thought you were going to die if you didn't get that little red wagon. You know, you thought you were going to die. And then you get it, and it's in the backyard, and you play with it every once in a while, but it's nothing like what you thought. And I said, yeah, that's because you were famous and I'm not.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, don't come to me about your damn little red wagon. You wait till I'm famous. But the interesting part is that now that it's kind of happening and it's just a hassle, you know, it's just, I ended up in the National Enquirer. It was just stupid. I did a Bob Mackey fashion show and I was the host and we raised all this money for AIDS and they dared me backstage to put on a Bob Mackey gown. He was expecting the piece de resistance, which was that Cher headdress that he designed. And they had a gorgeous black model that all she had on was pasties and high heels and she was going to strut out. Well, they put me in this little maid costume and Bob said, and now, and I came out with this thing. And so I ended up in the National Enquirer, half a page, and it's my sisters called me and they said, you know, mother has a guilty little secret. And our sweet little mother in Tennessee, she gets a quart of ice cream and buys those tabloids and she is going to, her bowels are going to let go. So you need to. But I called a good friend of mine. I'm real good friends with Carrie Fisher. Uh-huh. And she's had a lot of trouble in the press with drugs and things. And I called her and I said, Carrie, I'm in so much trouble. I said, my mother is, because my mother said, Leslie, why would you get in a 53 years old in a get up like that? Why would you do that? She said, the National Enquirer is like the Bible. Everybody reads it in the South. And I've got to go to Sunday school on Sunday. And you in that get up, a grown man in that get up. And so I called my friend Carrie Fisher and I said, I don't, she said, well, honey, I mean, I've been in and out of those tablets. She said, hang on, somebody wants to talk to you. Her mother, Debbie Reynolds, got on the phone and said, Leslie, this is Debbie. God. She said, listen, I want to tell you, I grew up in Texas and I know what you're going through. She said, when that woman stole my husband, I went, ah! Because you have to be a certain age to remember Debbie Reynolds. Elizabeth Taylor stole her husband. Yeah. She said, when that woman stole my husband, she said, I had to get a divorce. I mean, what could I do? She said, but back then, a divorcee was a slut. In the 50s, you did not get divorced. A divorcee. And she said, my mother would call me from Texas and say, a divorce. Debbie, we've never had a divorce in this family. And you out there living in West Hollywood. And I said, that's what my mama says. That's what my mama says. That I'm out here. So Debbie Fisher said, I want your mama's telephone number. And I said, oh my God. So I gave her my mother's telephone number and I thought, oh, I couldn't sleep. I was up all night long. And so the phone rang the next day and my mother goes, Leslie, what is going on? And I said, did Debbie Reynolds call you? She said,
She's on my answering machine. She said, "What, Leslie, what is going on?" I said, "Let me call Carrie and find out when you should call her." So I called Carrie, and I should probably say this. I said, "Carrie, when should my mother call?" She said, "Before 5. But anyway, y'all, I didn't say that. She said, "Before 5 o'clock. So my mother called Debbie Reynolds, and they were on the phone for an hour. Told her, she said, "Peggy, what you have to understand, in Hollywood, we do what they tell us to do. The minute you say, 'Oh, I don't do that,' then they don't call you anymore." She said, "I have been in this business for 50 years, and I still have to audition." And she said, "Here I sit with Mitzi Gaynor and Anne Margaret and all of these stars, and these young girls don't even know who we are, these casting girls." She said, "I had one ask me, 'So what have you done?'" Debbie Reynolds said, "I want to tell, I'm Debbie fucking Reynolds." "That's what I've done." Lots of stories.
So it does kind of, the success does carry the careful what you wish for, because it may bring you what you're dreaming about, and it may also bring a whole new set of problems that you hadn't thought about.
And you have to also, you know, I think it's so important for actors, like I said earlier, to find this sort of spiritual path, mm-hmm. and really, really know that you are okay. You're not your job. You know what right. I mean? Because what I would do is, when I was on unemployment and things were not going well, and the actor, I was shit, you know?
Right.
And then all of a sudden, whoo, it's happening, baby.
Yep.
And then
yep.
I'm up like this. But there was no sort of middle ground, you know? Right. And so I wish, if I had it to do over, I wish I'd gotten recovery earlier, but that didn't happen. That was that I concentrated a little bit more on me, you know? Get you some sort of spiritual path and get okay with yourself, because this business is tough.
Yeah.
It's tough, you know? I have my feelings still hurt all the time. I just had this thing happen. Linda Bloodworth Thomason, who wrote Designing Women, is my champion. I love her. She writes really good Southern. She had a series. She called me up and she said, "You know, I've written a series for you, and it's going to be you and Lily Tomlin." And I said, "Oh, my God, Linda." And she said, "Wait, it gets better. We're over at HBO, and we have a pilot order, and blah, blah, blah. And it's going to be you and Mary Kay Place." And I was just, is this happening? So we shot 6 episodes of the most. And I thought, you know what? I'm taken care of now for 12 years. This is going to be the best thing to hit TV. It was just brilliant. I loved it. It was called 12 Miles of Bad Road. We played the richest people in Texas. So everything I've got on came from that show. Everything. CKAK, Kenny A. Kingman, look, was my character's name. They made me custom made suits. I drove a Bentley. This is all you could see. I was the richest man in Texas. Well, the strike hit. So we had only done 6 episodes, and it had cost HBO $25 million. It was the most expensive comedy in the history of television. During the strike, Chris Albrecht, who was head of HBO, left. Carolyn Strauss, our champion, left. And they brought in this Dartmouth-trained lawyer from business affairs to run the network. I'm not going to say his name. I've never had an enemy in Hollywood in my life. I have an enemy now. But he hated this series. He said, "It's too broad for our network." And Linda would say, "Look, you don't hire Linda Bloodworth Thomason and put her words in the mouths of Leslie Jordan and Lily Tomlin and expect the John fucking Adams miniseries. This is what you ordered." And then he said, "We hate Leslie Jordan's character. He is a bad example for the gay community." And I went ballistic, because I thought, you know what? I have worked tirelessly for the gay community. You know, I have worked, and for this man, and then I found out he's homosexual. The head of HBO is homosexual. He not only canceled our series right out from under us, he buried it. TNT wanted it. Lifetime wanted it. It even got down to the HERE network.
with Paul Collum and said, I don't even want money, just please give it to me. And he said, you don't want that series. He said, Leslie Jordan doesn't even belong on TV. So I am now doing this other series where I play, it's on the Logo Channel. It's a smaller series with Olivia Newton-John. Y'all got to watch that. It's every Wednesday night. The Logo Channel on Time Warner is 146. It's way up there. And we did it. It's a labor of love. It's me and Rue McClanahan and Olivia Newton-John. And I play a man in the mental hospital who thinks he's Tammy Wynette. And I'm in full drag. And I'm never able to watch myself because I always, like I said, I don't think I'm quite as effeminate as I come off. And so I see myself think, girl, you need to calm down. And so, but I am so good in this television series. And Logo has promised me an Emmy push. And I thought, God, what? I want to stand there with that Emmy. And I want to say, is revenge not sweet? Kicked to the curb by HBO for being too broad, and I've just won an Emmy and a Tammy Wynette jumpsuit. Thank you very much. Kiss my rich ass, HBO.
There you go. Well, let's talk a little bit about the relationship that you've had with Del Shores over the years. I mean, that's been pivotal in your career.
I met Del Shores, 20, 30 years ago. He was my straight friend. I was best man at his wedding. I'm godfather to his... He's a writer here in town that was the head writer for Queer as Folk. He wrote Darman Greg. He created and helped write...
Daddy's Dying.
But his TV work, Deborah Messing's first series was called, it was Thomas Hayden Church, Ned and Stacy. But he's known for his plays, and he writes for me. You know, we have done play after play after play, and every year at the big, you know, theater awards, we win awards. But he was my straight friend. And I have really good gaydar. I can spot a homosexual at 40 paces. And he was my straight friend. And the phone rang one day, and he said, you know, Kelly and I are separated, and I'm godfather to his children, and it was just this huge mess. Well, anyway, he sat down and wrote this play called Sordid Lives. That's the one I was just telling you about. And we opened it at Theater, which if you go, there's Hollywood Boulevard in Cahuenga. There's Sharky's, which is a Mexican restaurant, and then there's the Greyhound bus station. Well, the Greyhound bus station used to be Theater. It was a 77-seat, tiny little dump of a theater, and we shared the alley with the methadone clinic. So there were all these heroin addicts and actors. I mean, we're perfect. We got along so well. The heroin addicts and the actors, and we had, and it was, and one, we did the play called Sordid Lives, and it got a cult following. And one night I peeped out, and there was Olivia Newton-John. We had known her sister Rona. We were all in a playwriting class together, Rona Newton-John. And here was Olivia Newton-John. And after it was over, Olivia Newton-John said to my friend, look, if you ever make a movie of this, I want to play that lesbian. And we went, and so we used her name, and we raised $400,000, and we videotaped this movie. Videotaped it. Now, this is not... You know, like George Lucas is using high definition. No, honey, this was video. We videotaped it like an old recorder. We made this movie, and it got this huge cult following within the gay community where people would show up like Rocky Horror Picture Show. If you go out to the West Hollywood Halloween Carnival, you'll see 10 of my character brother boys dressed up out there at the Hollywood Carnival. But anyway, now Logo bought it, and we've got a TV series of it. So it's been this 10-year journey. Mm-hmm. And then Dale and I are going in tomorrow to Showtime because we write together, and the buzz is happening because this series is doing so well. You know, other networks want us, so we're pitching an idea to Showtime tomorrow.
That's great.
Listen, if anybody can sing, our idea is this. We are going to do a mockumentary of a Southern gospel family called the Happy Hollisters. And... And it's a mockumentary, and anyway, we need people that can sing, big singers, so the Happy Hollisters.
Let's just take a moment, because you've talked about it, we've danced around a little bit. What drove you into recovery?
I didn't really understand what blackout drinking was. I mean, from the time I was 14 years old,
When I drank, I didn't remember a lot. I thought that was what happened. I didn't know you could wake up and remember anything. And so I've always kind of been a blackout drinker, but I started waking up on the freeway in the fast lane. Miles. One time, honey, I was clear up the grapevine. Don't know how I got there. And I thought, you're going to kill a family of five and have to live with that. So I got this DUI, and I was sentenced to 120 days in the Twin Towers. And so I, my lawyer kept saying, now you asked for the homo tank. Minute you get there, you asked for the homo tank. I said, what's the homo tank? He said, that's where they put the homos, because you don't want to be with the rest of those people. So they handcuffed me and they took me down, and there were these big redneck sheriffs sitting there. And so I said, excuse me. Well, they turned around and burst out laughing. I mean, I was just sitting there like this. And one of them said, what's the matter, little Bo Peep? He said, he was laughing so hard he was going, he said, did you lose your sheep? And I said, well, I said, what's the matter, little Bo Peep? So I didn't say anything. I mean, I'm not about to say it after all that. Can you please put me in the homo tank? Yeah, right. So I got put on the main line. Well, I did a movie with George Lopez when we were teenagers. We're practically teenagers. Well, no, he was a teenager. I was, you know. But early in my career, I did a movie called Ski Patrol with George Lopez. And all of a sudden, those homeboys in the jail recognized me from that movie, and I became kind of like their bitch, you know. So they protected me, these boys did. But finally, I ended up in the homo tank. I asked this one cop one day. I said, listen, can you get me in the homo tank? He said, are you homosexual? I said, real homosexual. I said, I am without a doubt the gayest man I know. And so I ended up in this jail in the softy ward. On the 11th day of my 120, I think it was like a religious experience, because I had a panic attack, and I didn't know what a panic attack was. But if you've ever had a true panic attack, it's almost like you're really afraid, you can't breathe, and you're going to scream and claw your face. And I remember I asked the turnkey, could I just take a walk? I said, I promise I'll come back. He said, no, you can't take a walk. I said, I'm giving you my word I'll come back, but I'm having a panic attack. And I prayed, and y'all listen, I was raised in the church, you know, but when you're raised in a religion that doesn't embrace you, I made a decision that I didn't believe any of it, you know. But I remember I said, you know, God, you might not remember me, but I was a young royal ambassador for Christ, but I've taken a little detour here. I'm in the jail cell. Can you, and I'm telling y'all, that knocked on the door, and they said, Mr. Jordan, we got good news, we got bad news. Good news is, We're letting you out. We got Robert Downey Jr. downstairs, and we got nowhere to put him. And we're going to let you out. The bad news is we cannot let you out, given your record, till the bars close. So you've got to share a cell. You're going to share a cell with Mr. Robert Downey. So we shared this jail cell, and he was really sick. I don't know if he was coming off dope or what, but this was December 11th, 1997. That's my sobriety date. Actually, October 27th is my sobriety date. But I said in that prayer, I said, you get me out of this one. I won't drink, I won't do drugs, and I'll dedicate my life to trying to help other people if you'll just please get me out of this. And so Robert, I got out, and I wrote Robert Downey Jr. a letter, but I didn't remember. Okay, wait a minute, I'm getting ahead of myself. 4 years later, I'm completely clean and sober, and I get a job on Ally McBeal. And I call my mother. I said, Mother, I don't watch TV, but I love that Peter McNichol. I'm going to give you the names of the characters, and you tell me if he's in my scene. I said, Larry Drake. She said, no, honey. That's that Robert Downey Jr. I said, oh, my God, Mama's in jail with him. She said, well, I wouldn't tell anybody. And I said, well, I'm not going to announce it to the cast, but I hope, I don't know if you remember. So I showed up on Ally McBeal. They introduced me to Calista Flockhart and everybody. I turned around, and there was Robert. He said, in front of everybody, do I know you? And I was kind of going like, like, he said, zip it, zip it. So
all day long, he'd come up to me, and I don't know if you know, if you've been on television, it's Fast and Furious. Mm-hmm. You just don't have a lot of, he'd come up to me. Finally, at the end of the day, he came up to me and he said, I know you. And I said, 152, pod A, cell 13. You were top, I was bottom. Because he was the top. I said, you were top, I was bottom. He said, what? I said, bunk beds. I said, we were in jail together. And he said, he looked at me and he said, you wrote me that letter. And he got kind of misty-eyed. And I remember there was a kid on our cell block that was HIV positive, and they treated him awful. Nobody would eat with him. They'd say, he got the AIDS. Don't eat. Don't go near him. I sat right down with him, and he got tears in his eyes. He got tears in his eyes. I sat with him, and he became my friend. So I thought, who's going to watch after this poor child when I leave? And so I wrote a letter to Robert Downey, and I was privy to where he was because he took my place. So I didn't know if they'd let him have it or not. I wrote R. Downey, 152, pod A, cell 13, top bunk, and I put it in the mail, and I forgot about it. He said, you wrote me that letter. And he goes, that letter, I kept that letter. He said, that letter meant so much to me. And that was the last time we spoke. I tried on the rest of the shoot to talk to him more, and it never happened. But, you know, I thought, after I got out of jail, I think the reason the whole thing stuck, we're taught in recovery that we give away what we have so freely been given. Mm-hmm. And I think it's so weird. I have this, I'll just tell you right now, I'm desperately, deeply in love with Robert Downey Jr. I'll admit it. I'd admit it to him if he was standing right here. And I read everything that's written about him. And I feel as if, you know, when I read that he's married, he's a wonderful father to his son. He's been clean for a long time. He's got this huge career back. He's the Iron Man. I had a little bit to do with that. Yeah. I did. Yeah. Because in recovery, see, we give back what we have so freely been given. And I wrote him a letter, and he, you know, has done for others, and this one has done for this one. And I think that's also, I have to tell you really quickly, are we running out of time?
No, we're good.
God,
keep going.
Lord, y'all, I've yacked.
We got another 3-4 hours to go.
But something else they taught me, the biggest lesson that I've learned in recovery was I was 2 years sober, and I called my sponsor and I said, I'm having a real trouble figuring out whether I'm a success or not. Hmm. And he goes, well, of course you're a success. I said, but I don't feel like a success. I said, I'm in a line of work where there's Jim Carrey making 20 million a picture. And then there is 85% of my guild that doesn't even make their insurance. Mm-hmm. So where am I? You know, I'm a working actor. My sponsor, my spiritual advisor, he is such an astute. He said, Leslie, this is the way we approach it. He goes, do you have a job coming up? And I said, yeah, my first job in sobriety. I'm doing 5 episodes of Caroline in the City, and it's an art. And he said, okay, you show up to be of service. He said, you show up to be of service to the producer. They have time constraints. You learn your lines, your own time. You don't make any waves. You're of service to the producer. You're of service to the director. It's his vision, dear. It's not your vision. He is the director. You are there to serve. You know, you certainly can bring what you want to the table, but the final line is it's his vision and you serve his vision. You're there to serve your fellow actors. Therefore, you're 4'11" with those big ears and that southern accent. You don't need to steal the scene. You know, you have to be giving. You're there to serve your fellow actors. At the end of the job, I want you to ask yourself, did I serve? Did I serve? And I called him. I cannot tell you the miracles that happened. One day I was working and one of the actors came over and he said, you know, you're usually so chipper. What's wrong? I said, I hadn't had a drink in 2 years. That's what's fucking wrong. I want a drink real bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
I said, it's a long time between cocktails. And I really need a drink. And he said, sit tight. He went over, turns out he was in recovery 4 years, went over and said to the girl, said, listen, Leslie and I are going to be gone about an hour. She goes, no, you can't leave. He goes, yes, we can. He said, I know where we are in the line of things, and you're not going to need us till this evening. And he took me to a meeting. Then this lady came up to me and handed me a candle. And we have a thing in recovery where if I take a cake with a candle my first year of sobriety,
I'm supposed to take that candle and give it to somebody who's new and say, put this on your birthday cake when you turn one, and then you give it to somebody else. This lady came up to me and she said, a little bird told me that you're trying to get sober. And she said, I celebrated 35 years of uninterrupted sobriety, including weekends. and gave me this candle. And so at the end of that job, I asked myself, you know what, did I serve? And I'm telling you, you know, we're in a line of work where you can get your ego stroked, and but just to be a worker among workers, you know, I'm telling you, my acting got so much better because I was just a worker among workers. I'm just here to serve. You know, what can I do here to serve? My audition process, where I would walk in with just this tiny little tweak, just a different mindset, where I would walk into the audition, not what can you do for me? I need this job. Can you do it? I would think, what can I do to serve this project? What could I bring to you? Never saying that, you know, just in my mind, that was my attitude as I walked into the door, you know, and I started, directors started using me again. Because I wasn't, you know, I wasn't one of these actors that caused any kind of trouble. I was there to serve. I mean, I'm there. I bring something to the table. You know, I think, well, I think this. But I remember it is the director's vision. I'm not the director. I'm an actor, you know, and I'm here to serve that vision. And they used to tell us in acting school, okay, look, maybe it's an orchestra. And you're over here just riffing away, you know, woo, woo, woo. But it has nothing to do with the piece. Right. You know, it's the director who's working the piece, and you're over here thinking you're, woo, you know, but it's not that, you know, I've got to serve the piece. And I started working like I've never worked before. And somehow in the midst of all of that over the years, it's also gotten to the point where I am just along for the ride. It's the greatest feeling. Now I remember waking up one morning and thinking, if there's any project in Hollywood where they want somebody that's 4'11" with a Southern accent and sort of a mama's boy, I'm going to be considered for it. Mm-hmm. And that was that thing that I wanted to get in, you know, that where you want to get in. And I thought, wow, you know, that's it right there, that I at least I know I'll be considered. And so, you know, right now I'm like this aging show pony. They trot me out. I just did 30 cities on a tour bus, signing books. I put my book. In fact, y'all have to come. I'm doing my one-man show, which you just got it for free.
But it's except opening. For the really good stuff. The really good stuff you say for the show.
It is. It's the Robert Downey Jr. It's every story I told you tonight. You got it for free. But so now you have to pay to come. It's at the Renberg Theater, which is in the Lily Tomlin, Jane Wagner Cultural Center, which is the gay and lesbian villages at McCadden. If you're old enough to remember the unemployment office, it's right there. Yeah. Now you do it by phone. But the unemployment office, it's the gay and lesbian villages, and I'm opening December, the first 3 weeks in December.
That's great. Okay. That, you know, that's such wonderful advice that your mentor gave to you in that setting. And I just couldn't help but think, I mean, it's great advice for somebody, whether they're in recovery or not in recovery.
Serve. We're
absolutely
here to serve. And we're here, you know, to help one another. And I noticed
it takes the pressure off you, doesn't it? In
it
some
takes
way?
All the pressure you know? Off of you. Also, I've noticed I go back east quite a bit now, and if you've done the audition process in New York, I will say this: L.A. is a little more relaxed. You know, you go into audition, and with me, it's always a little nebbish patrol. It's all the same. You know, with all these wonderful actors, I'm telling you, every part is the same five actors. We go in for the same parts. Sometimes I just want to scream and think, you know what? You need to go over to SAG. Honey, you need to go to some of these. You need to pull in some more fags because there's more than five of us. And all your, we just trade parts, you know. And so we, but in New York, I guess because of the rent and everything, it's cutthroat, man.
Yeah.
And they sit there and they size you up like this, you know. We're just chattering, you know. Yeah. They're like, you know, they're very serious, but
I Let's talk about some of the one-man shows and how you put them together. What's your process to do that? Because you've done, what, now three of them? Or
I have to tell you, if you can do this, I really started working when I immersed myself in the Los Angeles theater scene. Mm-hmm. You know, people say that there's, you know, that Los Angeles is a theater wasteland. It's not. It's alive and it's vibrant. And, you know, I started working when I started doing theater. That's when I started working. Number one, it seems to legitimize you a little more than this, the guy, because, you know, you can act from the neck up. Mm. I am appalled at the actors that are supposedly, I mean, I've worked with actors that have won Emmys at the height of their craft that I think that is the worst actor I've ever worked with alive, because they work from the neck up, you know. But I decided about 92 that you just didn't see this on the breakdown. You know, you're just not going to see 4'11". So I, because I'm a good storyteller, you know, I put together a show called Hysterical Blindness and Other Southern Tragedies that have plagued my life thus far. It was basically about my mother and having a gay son and her trying to deal with that. And it was wildly successful. You know, I did it. I put up my own money. I scraped together. That's not true. My three or four of us each put in $1,000, which was so much money. I mean, it was everything I had. And we rented the backspace at the Hudson, which was brand new then. They have a big backspace. And we got a tent. We could only do it at 10 o'clock at night. That's all we could afford. And we got an audience, you know, and I started doing this theater piece, and then it went to New York, and I did 7 months off Broadway, and then the big mistake I made was I was all of a sudden I was a darling out here. I was meeting, this was 1992, I was meeting with every head of every studio, and they wanted to do a sitcom, and this is the mistake I made. It's the only mistake I've ever made in my career, and I don't really regret it. But unlike Ellen, who thought, you know what, I'll play their game. But when my show is in the top 10, I'm going to come out. That was her plan from day one. Well, they would say to me, I'd meet with all these suits, and they'd say, we love that play. We love the stories about growing up in the South. We love the mother character. That was wonderful. We love the twin sisters. And I would have to say, there's a but in this room. There's a great big but. And what is the but? And they'd say, but we do not think that we can have a lead in a situation comedy, a gay character. Can you come back and pitch you without you being gay? I mean, that would be like telling, you know, a black guy or a Latin girl, you know, could you come back and not be quite so Latin? Or could you, I mean, it's just, so the mistake I made was I would tell my manager, fuck them, I'm not going back. And then, you know, it fizzled and it never happened. You know, then they never asked me again. I wish that I had come back and somehow tiptoed around the whole thing and come up with some great idea where I was a mama's boy. You know, I didn't have to be homosexual. I could be a mama's boy, you know, that was, you know, whatever I came up with. But I hit a real dry period after that. So there was a lot of like, see, you messed up, you know, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, it happens the way it's supposed to happen. And but then I wrote another one called Like a Dog on Linoleum, which is about my, I had a metaphor of when I used to get high on cocaine, I was like, you know how a dog gets on linoleum and there's a whole lot of activity, but it's just not getting anywhere. That was me. I was like a dog, very busy, but just not getting anywhere. I was so strung out on cocaine. So I wrote this one-man show called Like a Dog on Linoleum. It did really, really well. And now I've taken my book. I have a dear friend at Simon & Schuster, and he said to me, Leslie, you are such a great storyteller. Just sit down and write 10 pages. But I'd try to write, and when I tried to write, I couldn't hear my voice, you know? Mm-hmm. And then I would read it, and it just wasn't working. And then when I won that Emmy, I'm very involved with this organization called the Trevor Project. Right. And the Trevor Project is a suicidal hotline for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender youth. It's a national hotline. It's right here in LA, and it's manned 24 hours a day by people. When they plugged in 10 years ago, they got almost 15,000 calls of beautiful gay men and gay women who are considering suicide. Do you know where the majority of those calls came from? the Bible Belt, where I grew up. And so I thought, you know what? I'm not even on the D list with Kathy Griffin, but my story, for what it's worth, you know, reaching a point where I am comfortable, I am in my prime, baby. I am comfortable with who I am, what I am. Yeah. And to have come out of that, I said, I want to write a book. Well, what I pitched to them, because I didn't want to go in there and pitch that. I was kind of sneaky. I flew to New York on my own dime, and I went in the room, and I said, let me tell you something. I am a high school cheerleader stuck in a 53-year-old man's body. If you cut me open, Hannah Montana would jump out. I'm like, and I said, the reason is, I think that when straight guys were in junior high and they were learning the fundamentals of flirting and dating and they were finding healthy ways to deal with all that teenage love shit, where were the queers? Well, we were just kind of locked within our secret, especially gay men my age, and we were creating fantasies in our head. I have no earthly idea how to love in a healthy and blessed manner. I'll stalk your ass. That's what I'll do. I will stalk you. I have these fantasies. And I said, I have worked with George Clooney. I had a series with George Clooney before he got famous. I had a series with Billy Bob Thornton before he got famous. I had a series with Matt LeBlanc. Before he got famous, Luke Perry lived across the street from me, was laying concrete for 3 years. I fed him Thanksgiving because he couldn't even go home. And I have had torrid love affairs with all of them in my head, completely in my head, unrequited, angst-ridden, and made up. And I said, I want to write this book about my love affairs that I've had with all these people. Yeah. So that was the book that they bought. But then the book they got was more underneath it all, my journey towards acceptance. And so I'm so proud of it. It's kind of hard to get right now because I said, how many did you print? Because nobody can get it right now. They said, we printed 13,000. I said, just for my own knowledge, how many, because the same people just did Madonna's Brothers book. I said, how many of Madonna's Brothers book did you print? 250,000. I said, well, anyway, I think my book's more important. But
the title again?
It's called My Trip Down the Pink Carpet, and it begins at the Emmys, where the first story that I tell is at the Emmys, they allowed me, because I won my Emmy at the Creative Arts Emmys. See, I wasn't at the big Emmys. They do Best Guest Actor a week before. And so when I won, Cloris Leachman also won, and we're the same height, and they thought we'd be cute presenting. So we were invited to present at the real Emmys. Now, when you win an Emmy, that's all you get, that Emmy. When you present, you get that $52,000 gift bag. Yeah. I mean, we had a Christmas like you would not believe. My mother got $5,000 pearls. We had this Christmas. But they let us write our own patter. Mm-hmm. And so I would fax over to the writers. I said, okay, this is what I want. This, because Cloris said she didn't care. Mm-hmm. I said, I want Cloris to say I've won 8 of these, because she's the most decorated actress in Emmy history. She's won one more than Mary Tyler Moore. Wow. So I wanted her to say, oh, Mr. Jordan, I've won 8 of these, but one never forgets the first. And I wanted to say, Miss Leachman, I take mine everywhere. I even sleep with it. And then I wanted her to say, well, it's the only woman you've ever slept with. And I thought that was hilarious. They tried, but I said, no. They said, that makes her look homophobic. I said, no, it doesn't. It's funny. It can't be homophobic if a fag wrote it. You know, So we went back and forth. So finally they said, okay, Mr. Jordan, you can say it. Let her say her part, and then you say, so I walked out, and I'll never forget this, because we were backstage. This is the last story I'll tell.
We're backstage,
and I'm standing there, and I said, where's Miss Leachman? They said, she's had a wardrobe malfunction. I thought, my God, did her breast pop out?
She's
80 years old. They said, so I said, I can't go out there by myself. They said, well, you may have to. Because she's refusing. She's a nightmare, by the way. I adore her. She was right here. I said, she's a nightmare. 80 years old. So anyway, I turned around, and here she comes like the Queen of Sheba. She's like this. There are 5 wardrobe assistants stapling and sewing. She had ripped her dress all the way up the side. Literally, the guy is going, and in 5, 4, 3. I said, Miss Leachman, I grabbed her hand, and I said, Miss Leachman, 30 years in the business, I have never used a teleprompter. Do you have any hints?
And she wasn't paying attention. She's like, she said, well, I said, did you hear me, Miss Leachman? I mean, she said, shit. She said, my dear, just do as I do. I've won 8 of these. If I don't have it down pat by now, we're fucked. So she grabbed my hand and we swept out onto, and I mean, just like this. And Warren Beatty, Annette Bening, Seal, Heidi Klum, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, every star. And I just, you know, you just, and so we did our patter. She said, well, you know, Mr. Jordan, I've won 8 of these, but one never forgets the first. And I said, oh, Miss Leachman, I take mine everywhere. I even sleep with it. It's the only woman I've ever slept with. Huge laughter, huge. And I stood there and I thought, my God, I tossed that out. You know, I stepped off the bus in 82. I was riddled with internal homophobia. You know, I didn't know who I was, what I was. Here it is, 25 years later. I tossed that line out without one iota of shame, no hesitation, you know, and got this huge laughter. And I thought, what a journey. What a journey, you know. And so that's what I wrote. I wrote this book. But anyway, you have to come see the show.
Absolutely. Well,
do we take questions?
We're going to take a few questions here because we are going to be running short on time here. Stan would like to know, why do you think Southerners are so crazy and eccentric? Can you tell the crowd what biscuit slappers are?
Biscuits. I love what Linda Bloodworth Thomas, and I stole this line a long time ago. She said, in the South, we do not put crazy people away. We put them on the porch so everybody can enjoy them. I don't know what that is, but I tell you what I've noticed. I love English humor. You know, like when I watch those old sitcoms like Fawlty Towers and all those old English, Are You Being Served?
Yes, yes.
I holler. I mean, I don't laugh at anything on TV today. Nothing. I don't think anything's funny. And I watch those old shows and I thought, you know what? That's what Southern humor is, because it's based in character-driven comedy. We laugh because it's a character that we, you know, and we laugh at the eccentricity of the character. And that is what I think is so funny about Southern humor, you know, because there are, I don't know why it is, but look at all your great writers from Tennessee Williams to Truman Capote to Eudora Welty. It's always characters. And a biscuit slapper is my grandmother wore them. They're these little shoes, and when you walk, they slap.
Slap, slap, slap. Yep.
They sound like you're slapping biscuits. And that was in one of my shows, Biscuit Slappers. That's what a biscuit slapper is.
So maybe it's something in the water or the weather that creates all the eccentricities.
And my grandmother, I use her lines all the time. My grandmother, when I was little, I would pout. I'd put my lip way out. I'd pout when I didn't get my way. And my grandmother would go, look at Leslie over there with that big lip. She said, I could write the Lord's Prayer on your lip with a mop. Now, where does that come from?
That's a great line.
Or if she wanted, I would ask her, like, where somebody lived, and she'd say, oh, honey, way out in the country, way, way out, about 7 miles from where Christ lost his shoes. What does that mean? 7 miles from where Christ lost his shoes. And we had an aunt that drank, and nobody in my family drank. We were Baptists. And my grandmother one time said, you know, Fay Lou, honey, she could smell a bottle of bourbon clear across a mud flat, and she don't mind getting her dress dirty. I mean, that's colorful.
It is.
That is colorful.
That's great. Let's see. Leon Eves would like to know, what's the smartest thing you ever did to help yourself as an actor? P.S. She loves you.
Oh, I think we've covered that. I think the smartest thing I ever did for myself was get sober. That's the best thing I've ever done for myself. Mm-hmm. And who knew, you know, I had reached a point in my career where I remember thinking I was doing it by rote. I never equated the fact that I was drinking so much. You know, people forget that alcohol is a depressant. Mm. So if you drink when you're depressed, you're eventually going to get more depressed. And I remember thinking, you know what? I've been doing this for 16 years. The magic's gone. I mean, anybody is.
But see, no. You know, I love what I do now. And to have gotten that back, you know, that love of what I do and am good at what I do, you know, and that magic that what I do. I'm having so much fun with my show because it really is about gay men and Southern Baptists. And I was in outside of Boston, a little town called Provincetown, doing my show this last weekend. And this young man came up after the show and he tried to talk and he was verklempt. He tried to talk and he couldn't. And I just took his hands and he tried to say talk again and he couldn't. And finally, I just hugged him and I whispered in his ear. I said, I understand. I do. I know. And he walked off into the night. And I thought, you know, wow, you know, that what we do, you know, can really. I had a lady come up to me one time in a bus station. And I was waiting on a bus to go somewhere. And this lady came up to me and she said, you know, I am a recovering alcoholic. This is before I got into recovery. And she said, the first year of my recovery, there was no laughter in my life at all. None. She said, none. The laughter was gone. And she said, I saw you on this television program. And for the first time in almost a year, you made me laugh. And she said, I had decided I was going to have a glass of wine. She said, fuck it. I'm going to have a glass of wine. And she said, you made me laugh, and I made it through that night. And I want to thank you. And I said, God, you know, you never know. You never know.
Wow. You know, I just want to ask this question. Is there any role that you would love to play, or is there something, you know, in your craft that you've not yet had the opportunity to do that you're really itching to get at?
The only thing I want to do is Broadway.
Yeah.
And I'm close. There's a wonderful, he's doing 9 to 5 right now, Joe Montello, who has tried to use me. They offered me the Ritz. I was doing 12 Miles of Bad Road. I was offered a revival of Best Little Horses in Texas. I was doing something. That's the only thing I can think of that I really, really would like to do is some. Now, my show's going to New York, so maybe it'll go to Broadway. My one-man show is we're doing 6 months at Jackie Mason, the wonderful Jewish comedian, is in the New World Stages, and I'm going to take over for him. They said, because you are to the gays what Jackie Mason is to the Jews. So,
I can live with that. Huh?
I said, I guess that's a compliment.
I'm not sure. I think this says Mary here asked this question. Do you play an instrument?
I don't. I wish I was more musical. I don't even sing. I think I'd be great for musical comedy. I can sort of sell a song, you know, like a character voice. But I took piano lessons when I was a kid, and I wasn't very good at that. But no, I don't play an instrument.
Okay.
I think, though, you know what I thought a long time ago? This old guy, his name was Harry Crane, I think his name was. And he was an old writer, went all the way back to the Honeymooners. And his granddaughters are Melissa Gilbert, that was on Little House, and Sarah Gilbert. And the year I worked with Harry, their grandfather, Sarah had just gotten the Roseanne Barr show. And Harry came up to me and he said, I like your style of comedy because you hear the music. And I said, what do you mean? He said, my granddaughter, I have one granddaughter that's in comedy and she hears the music. And that's all he said. And I thought, you know what that is really? Because comedians, you have to hear the music. You have to hear whatever that rhythm is that makes something funny. Because two people can tell a joke, and one person tells it, nobody laughs, and then somebody else can tell it, and everybody's hollering. Well, what is that? It's a rhythm, you know. And I used to think in sitcoms, I'm perfect for sitcoms. I've been in sitcom hell for years. I've done every sitcom known to man. When I first started auditioning for sitcoms, my theory is, the early sitcoms, like I Love Lucy and all those shows, were written by Borscht Belt comedians from New York. And it's a rhythm. It's like that Seinfeld kind of, the Jewish comedians do it. Something that they do. It's a rhythm. And any actor worth their salt doesn't want to lay the joke out. You know, we're character driven, so we don't want to. And I finally had to learn how to lay the joke out. You know, and you'll feel stupid. You know, you'll feel like, this is not organic. This is not real to me. Well, lay the joke out. It's a sitcom, you know. Yeah. You lay the joke out. They set the joke up, and then you do the zinger.
Yeah.
And I've made a career out of it, and I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it because I heard a different kind of music. But anyway.
What changed that? Was it just the experience of finding what works and what doesn't?
Yeah, I think it was when I finally got on a series, and, you know, you've signed the deal. You know you got the money. They can't really fire you. And so I, you know, got to work every week, and you have to, you know, think. Because, you know, we're not saving babies here, okay?
No,
you know,
no.
And I used to chew my, you know, we're pretend. I love when actors go on talk shows and they say, you know, I do it because of the craft. I do it because I like to tap. You do it because you're a show-off. You do it because you're a show-off.
Yeah.
Actors, we're show-offs. We like to, you know, for whatever reason, you know, we like to, we want everybody to look at us. So.
Do you have a worst audition story, or
the only audition that I remember, that same Pam Sparks, she used to cast music videos when they were first being made, and it was a music video for Rod Stewart, and so I thought, wow, that'd be fun, and so I go in, and I'm, you know, you're just standing there, there's people, there was this English guy, and he said, so basically what it is you're in a discotheque, and you're dancing, and so we'd like to see that, please. No music. I said to him finally, I said, you know what, I don't think I'm right for this. And I left. But thus he said, you know, you're having a good time. You're in the discotheque. And you're dancing about. And
off of it. Good.
I mean, you felt so stupid. Another time, my favorite audition story is the guy that they said, come as a pilot. He thought they said pirate. So, he went to Western Costume and rented this hat with this plume and like this cape, and he walked in and everybody's in blue suits. And they go,
that's classic.
It's pilot. He thought they said pirate. You're going to make a fool of yourself, you know? You're just going to just make such a fool of yourself.
Jared wants to know, what was your very first professional acting job, TV or film?
I stepped off the bus in 82, and it was Valentine's Day, February 14th, 1982. I stepped off the bus, and I went to the professional artist group, and I started taking a commercial class. And they were doing a national talent search for this Aunt Jemima light syrup pancakes. And they wanted Barney and Fred, like from the Flintstones. That was the characters they wanted. Lost at Sea, and they had their Fred. And I walked in, and I got hired. My very first job was Aunt Jemima. I got my SAG card from it. Ava Shevitt cast that.
Yeah.
And every time I see her, I say, honey, I don't know whether to kiss you or slap you. I really don't. I said, I've had this wonderful career, but God, it's been a long, long, long. I don't know whether to kiss you or slap you. She got my SAG card for me. I got really lucky. That's another hurdle, you know.
Yeah.
God, just getting in the union. I can't even imagine what it's like now. But Aunt Jemima pancakes. And then... that's what I did the first 5 years.
You did a lot of commercials.
I did a lot of commercials.
All the time.
And I had this old, I'll tell you a funny, my second job, you're not going to believe this. I had this old agent named Don Schwartz, and he called me up and he said, they're looking for a spokesperson for the Selective Service. And I thought, a little queer like me trying to get boys to join the Army?
Yeah.
And when I was a kid, I was sent home from school with a note from the speech therapist that said, Leslie suffers from the sibilant S. Well, that's like a dead... anytime a comedian wants to do a homosexual, they add that S. We hiss when we talk a little bit of that S. So I have the sibilant S. And so I showed up at this audition for the Selective Service. And the Selective Service. And so there was a bed, and there was an 18-year-old boy asleep. And it was and I was his guardian angel pops on the headboard. And so they gave me the copy, and I thought, oh, I want you to count the sibilant S's. This, this was the copy. It said, Ralph, guess what today is? The Selective Service specifically states you must register at the post office within 30 days of your 18th birthday. Why not do it today, Ralph? So I left there thinking, oh, my God.
Yeah.
I got the job. I was the spokesperson for the Selective Service for 10 years. They would ran, 1982 is the year the MTV went on the air, and that commercial, because it was a PSA, which means a public service announcement, all you get is your session fee, $300. Yeah. So people thought I was getting hugely rich because they ran it like crazy. Well, I show up for the to shoot the commercial, and I thought, you know, my dad was in the Army, and there are all these Army guys here, and it was like this acid flashback, and so I thought, I better, you know, this is the Army.
Macho it up.
So I was kind of like, Ralph, guess what today is? The Selective. So the director came over to me and he said, whoa, he said, what happened to the flighty little angel that I hired? He said, did John Wayne eat him? So he kept telling me, just give me that flighty little angel. So, oh, y'all, it was, I would be sitting in a bar, and back then MTV was on every television set, every video screen, everywhere.
Yeah.
I'd be having the best time, and all of a sudden, hey, Ralph, guess what's up? I would, oh, God. I would hide. Because it haunted me. It was for years. You can still see it. It's on the internet. I'm swinging. I dressed. Also, I'll tell you another thing I used to do. Long before Pee Wee Herman, I didn't know who Pee Wee Herman was. I went and bought a vintage suit and a bow tie. And I thought, this is the way I want to sell myself.
Yep.
I had a commercial casting director sit me down and say, you know what, Mr. Jordan? You're cute, okay? We know you're cute. When you walk in telling us you're cute, you know, with that little bow tie and everything, it's like the girl with the baby look that comes in a baby doll dress. It's, you need to not, so, you know, I quit doing that. But when I went for that audition for the Selective Service, I had my bow tie on and I had these saddle shoes. And I remember the director kept saying, swing them. Swing the saddle shoes. He said, oh, that's hilarious. Swing your saddle shoes. Do it again and swing your saddle shoes. So I said, hey, Ralph, guess what today is? The Selective Service specifically states. I know there were people watching. This guy is trying to get people to join the Army? It was just a nightmare.
This was before the don't ask, don't tell policy was put into place. Wow. Let's see here. This is, again, this is anonymous, but please give advice to a young 5-foot comedian actor make it in sitcom films or what, et cetera.
Well,
I mean,
you know.
Does the height, I mean, you know.
It was funny. I was raised in such a way that I never really thought of my height. I think if I had been straight, it would be different. Because then you got to date the girls and it comes into play. It never came into play with me. Now, being Sissy did, but being short, you know, never bothered me. But I have to tell you, you know, there's going to be a call for short. It sets you apart, you know. You've got to find that one thing about you that sets you apart, you know, for whatever reason that you do. And I love when young actors say, oh, well, I don't want to be typecast. Yes, you do.
Yeah.
Because the minute you're typecast, they know what you do, then you work. And then who cares what happens after that? Then maybe you can go off and do theater and not be typecast. But if you want to work, you've got to find out what you do, and you've got to be able. And I tell you what the curse is if you're good looking. Mm. You know, that's the curse. When you're good looking. I'm trying to find a friend of mine, an agent right now, and he is the handsomest kid you've ever seen. They say, we've got him. Mm. You know, they put them in categories, and they say, we've got it. We've got good looking. We've got 5 of those who have done, you know, 3 guest stars and a thing. I said, yeah, but he's really good looking. And I say, listen, if you just get in the room and meet him, let's see, we've got that. So, you know, if you're good looking, you know, then you've got to find whatever it is about you that sets you apart,
you know, from the other good-looking guys, be it your personality, your, you know, it'd be wonderful right now to be Latin and to be bilingual. Because, I mean, my God, every commercial done is done now with in Spanish. You know, let that be your thing. The whole short thing, it's interesting because I don't look short. It's weird on camera because I'm fairly well proportioned. Mm-hmm. And so they have to, like, a lot of times try to make me look short, you know. Like, I remember I read one season for that sitcom that Brooke Shields did, Suddenly Susan. Mm-hmm. I read out of 22 episodes, I'm telling you, I went in there for probably 8 of them. I read and read and read. And finally the director said, you know what, it is not going to happen because every time we put you on camera and put you, every time you read with her, she has a real thing about being tall and big. Mm-hmm. And she said, he makes me look huge. And I don't want to look huge. And they said, but you know, Brooke, that's the joke. Well, it doesn't matter. I don't want to look like, I don't want to look huge. So sometimes it works against you, but I think the thing is to go with it, you know, go with it. That's your thing. That's what sets you apart from everything. And especially if you can do that short straight guy thing, which I couldn't do, you know, there's more comedy there with the short straight guys. Cause then, I mean, a couple of times, we finally got a gay sitcom, and I get hired for Ellen DeGeneres' show, and I'm so excited. I said, what's the character? They said, well, you're Jolie Fisher's boss, and you're married to a playmate, and I said, what? I'm straight? They go, yeah, you're real straight, Leslie. You like, you know, you got to be real straight. And there was the whole joke where I'd turn and right in her tits. And I thought, God, finally we get a gay sitcom, and I've got to go butch it up after all these years. I've got to go. And I thought I pulled it off. I'll tell you something really funny. I thought I pulled it off because I watched it and I said, wow, you know, I look like a little straight guy. Yeah. I had a friend of mine come from the Midwest and he was with all these gay guys that didn't know me. And right when I opened my mouth, one of them goes, ooh, get her. Get a load of her. I thought I'd pulled it off. I said, well, thank you. Thank you for that.
Well, we're kind of running out of time here.
God, I hope so.
Yeah, no. Believe me, this could go on longer. Well, you know? This has been great, Leslie.
Well, thank you.
I just want to end it on something that is obviously, you know, something that's so important in your life. I found a quote somewhere that said that you felt that you were in the midst of probably one of the greatest civil rights movements that's going on when it comes to gay people. And I found this quote here that says, two classes of gays, the fabulous and the fearful. The fabulous live on both coasts, but we forget about all of those that live in the middle of the country.
You do. We forget that there are still gay people who are deathly afraid of being found out, you know. And I have this great story that my mother, I mean, I've always had my gay life, and I've always had my family life. I've been out to my mom since I was 12 years old. And I told her, you know, I don't have crushes on the girls. I have crushes on the boys. And you know, they sent me to this Christian therapist who told me, when you have these thoughts, these sexual thoughts about people, this is the voice of the Prince of Darkness that you are hearing. And I remember thinking, he's got a loud voice. But anyway, I'm making some good money now. And I thought, you know what? I end my 30-city tour in Provincetown. It's a little whaling village at the end of Cape Cod. There's Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard. I rented an old sea captain's house that was built in 1840. I flew my mother, my 80-year-old aunt, my twin sisters, and my cousin Lynn, 5 old ladies in for this, I mean, lobster for breakfast. We'd have lobster. We had lobster omelets. I mean, lobster. We had this great. And my mother, for the first time, was thrown into my sort of gay world. And all of my gay friends embraced my mother to such a point that when she was getting on the ferry to send her home, she said, you know, my mother will never be Betty DeGeneres. My mother will never march in a parade with a sign. I'm the proud mother of a gay son. That's just my mom. She's just who she is. There's always, she'll whisper it now. She'll say, he's got a brother who's gay. But we're at this wonderful vacation, and my mother, all my life I've been haunted with the feeling that I was a disappointment to my dad. My mother told me this story. We're at dinner one night, and my mother said, my mother said, when I was 3 years old, I was a wiggle worm. And blah, blah, blah. And so they had to take me to a wedding. Couldn't get a babysitter. They were worried to death. And I'm wiggling in the church pew, just wiggling. And my mother's,
And all of a sudden, the bride came down the aisle, and she said, I froze. I could not get my eye off that bride. And I watched that bride. And so I went home, and I was in the next room playing with my cousin Karen, and we were playing Bright and Goon. And I was making her, I had an angel food cake pin on my head. I was the bride. And I 3 years old, and I was making my cousin be the groom. And we'd play bride and groom. Well, Christmas came around, and we'd go to Loveman's department store, and you'd sit there on Santa Claus' lap and tell him what you wanted for Christmas in front of everybody. Well, here's my lieutenant colonel of a father. And I said, I want a bride doll. I want a bride doll. And that's all I talked about. And so Christmas Eve came around, and my dad said, oh, my dead body. This is 1958 in the hills of Tennessee. And my daddy said, over my dead body, I'm going to get that boy a bride doll. Well, Christmas Eve, that's all I could do. Get me a bride doll. Right. So my mother finally told my daddy, she said, Alan, you're going to explain it to him in the morning because I don't know what to say. My daddy went out Christmas Eve, 1958, and scoured Chattanooga, Tennessee, and found his three-year-old son the most beautiful bride doll. And my mother said, when I came down the steps and saw it under the tree, I squatted in the floor and peed. And so my mother, I'm 53 years old. I'm 53 years old. And my mother told me that story. And I thought, you know, all that baggage that we carry from our childhood, he just wanted me to be happy, you know. And I love what my spiritual advisor said. He was doing the best he could with the light he had to see with. You know what? It was 1958. And what's the greatest fear a man could have? That his son was going to be homosexual. And I left little doubt. So anyway, I've talked enough. Y'all thought.
Leslie, thank you so much. Good luck on the show.
Thank you for listening to the SAG-AFTRA Foundation's Conversations podcast. If you appreciated what you heard, please support us with a review or donation. And reach out to us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at SAG-AFTRA Found. We'd love to hear from you.